Hey guys, and welcome to the show. This week we have Aaron Margosis with us. He's a principal consultant, and he's going to talk to us about security guidance for Windows 8.1, a very, very, very important topic. So without further ado, play the music. Hey Aaron, how you doing, bud?
Really good. How are you?
I'm doing good. So, principal consultant for cybersecurity, just give us a quick rundown of, you know, what that entails. What do you normally do day to day?
Well, the cybersecurity services team is involved in a lot of different types of things, including incident response as well as proactive architecture changes like the Enhanced Security Administration environment to help reduce the likelihood of pass the hash and credential theft attacks. As well as security development lifecycle. So Michael Howard, who wrote the books on writing secure code, is on our team. And so we engage with customers in a number of different ways.
Awesome. So Windows 8.1 security guidance. You know, I was under the impression, as I think a lot of people probably are, that 8.1 is the most secure operating system that we've ever released out of the box. And that's probably true, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely true.
So I know that our operating systems, you know, keep getting more and more secure. For instance, XP was you know, not really very secure. Windows 7 was a lot better. Windows 8 was better than Windows 7. And 8.1, you know, is even better than 8 was. But there's still a lot of things our customers can do to make themselves more secure.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure I'd completely agree with you about the history of the operating systems that way. Windows XP was fairly secure when it came out, but after the Trustworthy Computing Memo that came out in 2001, or 2002, I guess, you know, Windows XP Service Pack 2 definitely raised the bar on security. It was a secure operating system for the time. Threats have continued to evolve, though, and we have done more and more in response to that. So I think Windows 7 remains a very secure operating system, but as the threats evolve, we have to continue to evolve the defenses as well. So the idea behind the security guidance, though, is for consumers, Windows ought to be fairly secure out of the box. They don't need to do a whole lot, you know, add some anti-malware perhaps or things like that, and you know, don't trust things that come in, although we do have some defenses like Smart Screen that will help defend against some of those social engineering attacks. For enterprises, though, a well-managed enterprise, they can take away those security decisions from end users. And that's what we recommend well-managed enterprises do, is have security experts make the big security decisions and not have all their end users make those one-on-one. So, first of all, end users should not have admin rights in a well-managed environment. Admin tasks are performed by the system, by enterprise management software. Now, there's some things that need to be done as far as application deployment, but you know, those can be increasingly done on demand for apps that are actually needed, and not just, you know, some random screensaver that someone wants to install. Then what we do with the security guidance is we recommend for a well-managed environment, here's a bunch of security settings that we believe you will be better off enforcing, not just have as the defaults. The defaults are good, and in a lot of cases, what the policies do is enforce the defaults and reinforce the defaults. But what this does is it says end users cannot change the defaults. And so, for example, things like what is trusted sites. You know, that is a security decision because it opens up anything you're running within trusted sites has a lot more access to your computer than stuff running in the regular internet zone. This is with Internet Explorer. And so we recommend a lot of these types of lockdowns to help keep enterprises more secure. And this guidance is targeted toward the enterprise, not for consumer.
Cool. So let's talk about trusted sites for a second, just so that everybody understands, right? With just an out-of-the-box copy of Windows, I can control kind of what goes into trusted sites and what doesn't go into trusted sites.
Exactly.
And so I think what you're saying is that anything I put in trusted sites gets a whole range of rights and access that maybe something that's not in trusted sites doesn't get. So you're talking about preventing people from adding things to trusted sites or having a policy that's managed at the enterprise level for preventing people from putting things in trusted sites.
Exactly. That's one of the policies that's in the recommendations, is that the IT administrators, the controllers of group policy, are the ones who say, this is what is in trusted sites. One of the things you give up when you go from the internet zone to trusted sites is protected mode. Protected mode is a defense that was added to Internet Explorer beginning in Windows Vista and IE 7 that runs Internet Explorer as a less trusted application, and it does not have access to things like the run key and the startup folder and things like that. So it becomes another hurdle that the attacker has to get around before they can take control of your user account, let alone your computer. So things in trusted sites, that barrier is removed. And so that's something that you don't want end users just deciding, oh, this site's not working. Let me see what happens if I lower the security settings on it.
Right. You talked about pass the hash attacks, right? Is that something that we still see a lot of?
Oh, absolutely. Our incident response people say that pretty much every environment that they walk into, and the ACE team also, the I don't remember what ACE stands for, it's another group under MSIT, every environment, every customer environment they go into where they see compromise, they almost always see pass the hash as after the exploit, they gain admin rights, then they start traversing around the network using pass the hash as a way to do it. And the reason for that is because the attack mechanism has been commoditized. It's been turned into a toolkit that dramatically lowers the bar to using it as a means of getting around. And so we're finding we need to defend against that more and more. And in fact, our security guidance adds some settings specifically to block some of the common avenues that pass the hash attacks have been using. For example, using local accounts in an enterprise domain environment, local accounts really shouldn't be needed for traversing the network. They should be used, if at all, only on the local machine. And so we've added settings that prevent the use of local accounts across the network, and that blocks one of the avenues which is commonly used for pass the hash attacks, is taking the local administrator account or a local administrator account and using that to traverse from computer to computer until you find one that has highly privileged credentials on it and then take over the entire domain. So this the guidance that we've published can block a lot of that from happening.
Are we the only OS that's vulnerable to that, or are other OSs vulnerable to pass the hash as well?
So the reason it's called pass the hash is because of NTLM, which is a protocol, a network authentication protocol that's evolved for a long period of time. It was defined for Windows, and it takes the user's password and generates a hash. And this particular credential theft mechanism takes advantage of that. However, the general problem of credential theft, which is really what pass the hash is just one example of, is common to any type of environment where there's single sign-on. Any place where you've got credentials, those can be stolen, and whoever can steal those credentials can act as you.
Well, I was just going to say, the reason I asked that question is because I think that there is a misconception out there, right? I think people hear pass the hash and they think, oh, yeah, that's a Windows issue. And it's a Windows issue because, like you said, we are talking about the NTLM hash, but it's not a unique Windows problem. Every OS that puts anything credential-related on the wire is susceptible to these types of attacks.
Exactly, yes. Now, as pass the hash, of course, gets a lot of press, one, because Windows is a very prominent platform, but also because pass the hash just sounds so cool, right?
Yeah.
Compared to credential theft, which sounds a little more mundane. But pass the hash, you know, takes you back to Haight-Ashbury, and, you know, I think people get a kick out of that somehow.
I think that's actually the first Summer of Love reference we've ever had on TechNet Radio.
I'm sure I'll get in trouble for it.
All right, so what else do we have in the security guide? So, you know, what other types of things do you have in that in those recommendations?
Okay, let me show you. Here's, as you can see on the screen, here's the blog where we're posting the security guidance. It's blogs.technet.com slash bit.ly/secguide, and a bunch of different things in here. The security guidance is based on the guidance that we originally published for Windows 8 and Windows 7 before that, and Windows XP before that, and Vista was in there too, of course. So this is an evolution of that. And what we've highlighted in some of the settings here are places where we have modified guidance from the past. And so, let's see, we published a beta several months ago, and so we have a blog post just about what has changed since the beta. And then there's what's new in recommended security baselines compared to what we had in Windows 8. And I was going to post the entire document here on this particular blog post, but it didn't format very well with the blog theme that they use. So it's just here available as an attachment. And let me just show you that. So here is the Word document where we talk about some of the changes we made, including some pass the hash attack vector mitigations, blocking the use of web browsers on domain controllers. It's a bad idea to use a web browser on a domain controller, or really any kind of server. But to start with, what we're going to do is use AppLocker to block the use of common web browsers, including Internet Explorer, Firefox, and Chrome, on domain controllers. And of course, you know, if you're admin and logged onto a domain controller, you can bypass this. But this is a reminder that this is a bad idea. Don't do it on this particular machine. We have added the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit into the standard baselines. This is a tool that came out of Trustworthy Computing, the TWC group. And it's an add-in that you can add to Windows that helps defend against future attacks, against unknown vulnerabilities. And what it does is it blocks common attack techniques, return-oriented programming, buffer overflows, and things like that, into a variety of programs that may not have that defense already built in. And so this can prevent your environment from being compromised by malware for unknown or unpatched security vulnerabilities. We have tidied up some of the settings where we realize that particular settings don't actually provide any value, so we've removed a bunch of settings, and that's described in the document. Another one here is also FIPS mode. We have decided not to continue recommending that. This is a setting that is kind of mandatory in federal government environments, but it has a lot of drawbacks to it, and we actually wrote up in one of the blog posts here. Earlier. We're not recommending FIPS mode anymore. And we talk about what it does, what some of the drawbacks are, how it causes a lot of trouble, and why we think you can be just as secure without FIPS mode on. And this goes into detail. But we're not saying don't turn it on. We're not saying don't enable it. We're saying we don't recommend it. We don't recommend disabling or enabling. If you want to turn it on, that's up to you. So if you're in an environment that mandates it, then yeah, go ahead. But we're not going to make it part of our security guidance for enterprises in general.
Yeah, and that would be any federal agency would probably have to have it. Anything that we service through PubSec would have to have it. My customer's NASA, so they would probably have to use FIPS mode.
Well, what we found is, that it's been mandated through the DISA STIGs and the U.S. government configuration baseline for a long time, and it tends to be one of the settings that organizations take a waiver on and say that, because of this, that, and the other, we're not going to enable that particular setting. So we find that FIPS mode is not actually enabled, even in a lot of the federal environments where it is supposedly mandated. So it goes.
Interesting. So hang on. So that's really cool. So in the doc that you just pointed out, right, we actually go through all of the pros and cons?
This particular document goes into some of them. We kind of summarize why we have enabled or disabled some of these settings or removed some of the settings. Some of the blog posts go into more detail. So for FIPS mode, that's a pretty long discussion. And so for that one, you've got multiple pages of text here about, justifying, why you may or may not want to use it. Another one also that gets a lot of discussion is account lockout. And this is one where our security guidance has changed, you know, like pretty much every single release, we adjust the guidance. And this one, we changed it yet again, but go into a lot of discussion about, you know, for your particular environment, you know, you may want to turn off account lockout completely. You may want to set the threshold to 50 the way we used to recommend. You may want to set it lower, but here are some of the trade-offs that we have seen that cause problems with this setting. Now, if you have an environment, and this has never been called out in the guidance, if you have an environment where you've got smart cards only, smart cards required for interactive logon, you should probably disable account lockout because there's no password guessing when you've got what we call the Skrill settings, secure smart card required for interactive logon. There's no way to guess a password. So account lockout can only be used at that point for denial of service and cause accounts to be locked out. There's other things here about how you can reduce or eliminate the need for the lockout. Now, for the security baseline, we can only pick one setting. And so we picked a setting we figured will be a good trade-off for most environments. But this is not something where we say, this is the best setting for all environments. This is one where we said, this will probably work well for you without causing too much trouble, but you should consider all the pluses and minuses here and decide whether this is the right way to go or not for your particular environment. Of course, for some environments, they've got, you know, mandatory settings that say, you know, 3 bad passwords and you lock out. I think, I can't remember which ones. I think some of the credit card processing or banking or DISA, you know, the DoD will say 3 is the account lockout threshold, which, you know, is really extreme, especially when you've got multiple devices that are, you know, logging in and you change your password and then all of a sudden you still have your devices that are still logging in using the old password, and that can cause problems later on. So that's discussed in detail in this particular blog post.
Okay, that's cool. That's really neat. I could, you know, this document looks like it would be incredibly valuable for really any IT organization.
I'd like to think so.
Yeah.
Quite a bit of time and talked to a lot of people gathering advice and recommendations and talking to our support people and talking to them about some of the support cases they've seen and how expensive account lockout settings can be. When you have account lockout and figuring out what is causing the account to be locked out, you want to reduce the accidental lockouts. The reason for account lockout really is to prevent someone from hacking into your account by guessing the password, right? But oftentimes we see it, you know, accounts get locked out by accident, and those are the kinds of things you want to prevent from happening because it can be really expensive getting those accounts re-enabled.
Right, especially, you know, if somebody had access, they could essentially take a bunch of usernames and just randomly send bad passwords to perform, you know, denial of service attacks.
Oh, yeah, it'd be very easy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so this is awesome. I know the first thing I'm going to do after we get done here is take this link and send it out to my customers because it's something that I think that they would absolutely get a lot of mileage out of.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Yeah.
We welcome any feedback on it too. Anything anybody sees regarding the guidance, regarding account lockout, FIPS, whatever. You know, it's a collaborative process, and, you know, we worked with the Department of Defense on this. We worked with the Center for Internet Security. We really are looking for what is the best way to help secure the entire environment, not just Windows, but the entire ecosystem.
You mentioned feedback. You mentioned people providing feedback. How, if somebody reads this and they want to provide feedback, you know, what's the mechanism for that? What's the best way to do it?
Probably the best way is just click on the email blog author link right here on the webpage of the blog post under options. So one other thing I did want to mention also is a lot of federal agencies look to NIST for security guidance, and for Windows XP, Vista, and Windows 7, NIST published the U.S. Government Configuration Baseline, USGCB, which recommended a lot of security settings that are essentially mandatory for use in federal environments and federal contractor environments. And they stopped doing that after Windows 7. They never published USGCB for Windows 8 or anything newer. And what they've done instead, and this is something that a lot of federal agencies aren't aware of, is NIST recommends, if they don't have specific guidance, they recommend go to the vendor for security guidance. And that's what this guidance represents, is the security guidance you need to deploy Windows in your environment. So if they're holding up deploying just because of lack of those settings, then this is what you need. This is what you've been waiting for. There, some of them will go to the DoD recommendations, the DISA STIGs. They can do that as well, but those tend to include a lot of settings that are very onerous and cause a lot of problems for non-military environments. They, for one thing, they block any kind of communication back to Microsoft for services like, get me the latest certification authority trusted root certificates, right? And the DoD and intelligence agencies have to manage those root certificate stores on their own. And that's a rather onerous process for a lot of environments. They also don't get the benefit of Smart Screen, which depends on an up-to-date reputation service, which is hosted at Microsoft. And so, it's understandable that in a DoD or intelligence agency environment, where you're maybe, checking out sites that may be sensitive and you don't want to release, you don't want anyone knowing that you're going there, you don't want anything like that to find its way back to Microsoft.com. But for most use, for most enterprise use, most civilian agency use, that's not an issue. And so you're better off using Smart Screen and using the latest up-to-date root CA certs rather than turning all those features off. So using the DISA STIGs can cause you more trouble than it's worth. And the security guidance we've published, I think, will be more appropriate for those environments.
Awesome. And so just to recap, this stuff is all available on blogs.technot.com/b/secguide, correct?
That's right, yeah. Oh, and one other thing also is the Security Compliance Manager, which a lot of people have used to manage their group policies. That will also be containing it will be getting updated CAB files so that you can get this within the Security Compliance Manager, hopefully within the next week or so. They've lagged a little bit behind the publishing of the guidance that we published on the blog, but SCM will be getting those CAB files very soon.
And how does a customer go about getting the SCM?
There are links, again, on the SecGuide blog site, or just search for Security Compliance Manager on Microsoft.com, and you'll get a link.
Awesome. Well, Aaron, listen, I'd like to thank you for being on the show. This has, been incredible. This is really valuable information. Hopefully everybody gets a chance to visit the site and reads these documents and puts a lot of this stuff into practice.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. It's great to finally make it on the show.
Yeah, no worries. Feel free to come back anytime. This is, like I said, great stuff, and it's certainly something that I'm going to be packaging up and sending out to my customers. So I know that they'll see it, and if you're listening to the show, hopefully, you go up, you check out the site, because, again, these are invaluable. There's nothing more important than protecting your environment, and this is the key to doing it. So without further ado, again, thanks, Aaron, and that's your Taste of Premier.